energy and the further adventures of the Liberal Party and One Nation. Our topics this week, welcome to another installment of the Double Disillusionist, Andrew P. Street. We have some wonderful news, some delightful news.
We do. We're live. Well, we're alive, but aside from that, we're also doing one of them live show things.
Yes.
That we did last year that were really fun.
Two of them in March and April, the 7th of March and the 4th of April at Giant Dwarf in Redfern. You can book at giantdwarf.com.au. You can go to our Facebook page, The Double Disillusionists. It's really easy to spell. Book and enjoy. Lots of excellent guests on the way. The lineups are just, they're crystallizing moment by moment, aren't they?
They are. Well, I think we can give a hint as to one of the lineups and say that we'll be joined by Mr. Mark Humphreys for the very first of the podcast for the March event.
We will on the 7th, but there are more coming as well. More names being
this
locked
is true.
In.
We'll drop them as we see fit.
Yes, the very high level. It's the very complicated process. We've got all these
indeed
representatives, and anyway, that's going to happen. But today, our guest is contributing editor to the Monthly and all round nice guy, ex-colleague of both of ours for many years standing, Mr. Richard Cook. Hey, Richie.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Yeah, very well.
This is
welcome back.
It didn't occur to me you're an ex-colleague of both of ours. This is very exciting.
Maybe for you guys.
I feel like we're in a love triad.
Oh,
yeah.
Shut up.
Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. You used to work with Andrew at Time Out Sydney.
That's right. And with you, Dom, at The Chaser, among other enterprises.
Yeah, they were good days. You'll have to take our word for it. But look, as for these days, I don't know how good we can call them. Things are getting stranger week by week. This week, we've learned that the way to solve our energy future is to redefine coal so that it's clean energy and thereby eligible for the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. A brilliant and much easier than actually making energy clean solution. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, I don't know what's going on. I'm just confused by this whole process. So where things are at now is that this is definitely not a repeat of the carbon tax scare thing, where we were talking about how prices were going to skyrocket if we embraced renewable energy. This is totally different. This is where prices are going to skyrocket if we don't embrace energy security, because that's what it's about now. It's about energy security, which is, I think, where you get energy and you put it in a nice little safe box and you keep it there until you need it, and you're South Australia, I think, is the deal. This is all based around the idea that when there were the storms in South Australia and a bunch of wires and poles were blown over.
On the night of your book launch, Andrew.
The night of my book launch, no less. When South Australia, my former home state, put all its lights out in tribute, which I thought was very nice of them.
So, yeah, the stoush over what happened in South Australia, the different reports that have come out, it's been quite intense. Our very favourite Twitter commentator, Chris Keeney's, had a lot to say, a lot of scorn to pour, Richie, on anyone who suggested that it was anything other than renewable energy's fault. And the folly of the Labor government in SA in putting all of its eggs in the renewable basket.
Yeah, that's right. And look, energy policy is notoriously one of the most complex areas in political policy. It's kind of like the equivalent of the Arab-Israeli conflict in foreign policy or neurology in medicine, that from the outside, it looks like it should be easy to solve and very interesting. And from the inside, people can dedicate, you know, very smart people often can dedicate their entire careers to it and not really fully understand it at the end, sometimes of decades of work.
So you're saying that we need Trump to come in and offer that not sold on a one-state solution, a two-state solution thing, sort of from the outside?
Yeah, that's... Look, Trump is the answer to all complex policy problems as far as I can see.
Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is strange, isn't it? I mean, increasingly we're seeing that people's preconceptions simply determine what they see in any situation, and goodness knows I've got mine. But when I look at South Australia, I see people who are, it seems, an absolutely stark example of ignoring the experts, ignoring the reports, simply making the conclusions that you want to, And the government's seen this as carte blanche for bringing a lump of coal into Parliament and saying, we're back.
Yeah, and I think there's a kind of element of symbolism here as well that you'd see in the energy kind of debate. I mean, it's well known that conservatives, for example, or some conservatives, maybe not quite as many as there used to be, are advocates of nuclear power. Now, nuclear power is incredibly expensive. It requires huge amounts of government subsidy to operate. The plants are very, very expensive to build.
It's very clean until it isn't.
That's right. And so
you've got to decommission the things. They seem to go very quiet about that bit.
That's right. And look, you kind of wonder why they're so excited about it. And the reason is because it makes lefties feel upset. And they consider alternative forms of, you know, non-fossil fuel energy to be kind of a bit effeminate.
Yep. Light her up. If only you could make renewable thing where you burn things. But look, to be fair to coal, it is renewable. If your time scale is in the millions of years, it's utterly renewable. There's going to be more of that stuff in, you know, the year 1 million or so. There'll be heaps more.
See, yeah. I'm very excited by the idea that if renewable energy is seen as effeminate, maybe that's the way we should be marketing it, sort of like a kind of an epilady thing, sort of energy for ladies. I think that's probably the way forward.
Pink windmills is what we do. Yeah, why are they white? It's ridiculous. Make them pink.
Yeah, Joe Hockey never would have complained about pink windmills in the same way.
I love daintily spin.
I hate it the way that everything gets back to Trump, but Trump's battle against the windmills offshore in Scotland, literally tilting at windmills, it's just the best. Anyway, that's not the. If people have seen the piece on, I think it was Samantha Bee's program, Full Frontal, where they went and talked to the Scottish people who deposed Donald Trump. It's well worth seeing. But look, this debate keeps going on here. And the strange thing about it is that, as we've said previously, Andrew, Malcolm Turnbull seems like Captain Renewable. He seems like the guy who would essentially ride a waterfall down to political office, taking all of us into a bright rainbow future. What's happened?
I think part of it is that he's in a weak position. And
this has never come up before.
It's almost as though he will win power. Anyway,
It's news to you guys, but... part of it is that he lacks power, ironically, and the other element is that he's trying to do something, let's not underestimate this, that is really, really hard.
Yeah, his power may not be renewable. Anyway, yeah, look, he's in between a rock of coal and a hard place, isn't he? Now, what's the hard thing he's trying to do?
Well, I mean, one person to me has compared changing the energy mix over time to trying to rebuild the fueling system of a 747 while it's in the air. One of the kind of elements of making electricity work in this way is that things that seem like political decisions being taken now are in fact engineering decisions which were taken 25 years ago. So it's very, very difficult. I mean, there's a famous example now. And I know that this is a favorite stat of our friend Chaz Licciardello. So in the US, you know, most jobs now in energy, most new jobs being put on are in solar energy. You know, they're more people are going to work in solar than are going to work in gas or coal. And 5 years from now, solar energy is expected to constitute about 1% of the USA's energy needs. That might just be electricity needs. So the moment is arriving, but the real moment won't be arriving for 25 or even 50 years.
Yeah, and this is the thing that seems really odd to me, is that if you're going to be an economic rationalist and, you know, even take an unashamedly rationalist approach to national affairs, like another friend of ours, surely just on the economic argument, renewables are looking good. I mean, for the one thing, you build a windmill, it just keeps generating power. But also, from what I understand, and it seems as though Al Gore years ago essentially took a deep breath and relaxed because solar was becoming so cheap that he was going to win the argument just on price, given that he couldn't convince any of us to do, you know, to go green for the whole saving the planet thing. And when you see places like India and China rushing full steam ahead to embrace solar, places like China where they simply can't breathe, so they need to get away from coal, it does seem very odd that we, at this point in 2017, are trying to be the last country standing on all this.
Well, the other thing that's kind of a little bit worrying about the coal argument is that part of the reason why we're now redefining redefining its clean coal and looking at ways of using the Renewable Energy Fund for to invest in clean coal or carbon capture and stuff like that, is because doing it without this kind of subsidy is economically unviable. So the economic argument is no longer standing up. And so the government is actually in this very sort of, I think, invidious position of arguing that we need to subsidize a form of energy which the vast majority of Australia, if today's essential poll is to be believed, just do not buy. Nobody seems to think that the future is coal, or a very, very small percentage of Australians think that the future is coal.
Well, you say that, but what if some of the money that was being used to try and develop clean coal initiatives and reduce the pollution, what if that were tipped into an advertising campaign and a website, littleblackrock.com.au, coal, it's an amazing thing. And I'm looking at the website now. There's a piece of coal that is rotating on the screen. That doesn't come cheaply. It's a website full of the amazing things that coal can do, the wages that it creates, and the fact that it can reduce its emissions by up to 40%. I do love those words, up to. They're so non-binding.
It sounds like an Oil of Olay commercial. We're like, reduces visible wrinkles by 16%.
Well, coal can do that as well. I don't
exactly
realize this.
Well, and look, it does it as much as Oil of Olay does.
It's a much more modern and funky website than, in fact, coal deserves, to be perfectly honest. And the fact that they're pouring all this money into this campaign, I mean, I don't want to rush to massive conclusions, but it looks a little bit like they're running scared here, Richie.
They know they've got a big PR problem, and they have had for a long time. You know, coal has been the most unpopular way, along with nuclear, of making energy for, you know, over 10 years, both here and in the US and in other countries.
Have they done the survey since Scott Morrison said coal was his best friend and brought it into Parliament? Because I think the numbers may have changed, just quietly.
Everybody loves Scott and Coalsy.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one way to increase your popularity, it's having Scott Morrison say that he's your mate.
Look what he's done for Christianity.
Yeah. Exactly. That guaranteed man bump. He's basically Australia's sweetheart. He's the new Lisa McCune.
Yes, Lisa McColl. You look at the website, it's quite impressive. The lump of coal just dances and swims around. Lots of stats come up. And the world's population is going to grow, it says here, from 4 billion in 2015 to 6.3 in 2050. You try and get there without coal, go on. Try, Richie, try. But this is the thing. It's happening. I mean, China and India, a billion people each, they've got factories. They don't actually need the West to come in and solve the problem for them. They're doing it themselves. Narendra Modi is determined to just simply bypass in all the rural villages that don't have power. He's just going to put solar cells in. And why shouldn't he? It's cheap.
Well, China
and
are also
you can
now...
just leave them there.
China are also, as of Sunday, I believe, cancelled all of their imports from North Korea, which was mainly a political decision, it should be made clear, but the fact that their power generation can now stand having those kind of political stunts done is itself an indication. It's also a huge problem for North Korea, who now suddenly don't have their major source of foreign income.
Well, their new export is actually assassination, so that'll probably go quite well.
And reality television. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, the way that they've brought those two together, finally, I mean, you know, we all knew it was going to happen, and I think we all knew it was going to come from North Korea.
Kim Jong-un-tastic. Yeah, look, this is strange. I mean, this government does seem to be... Given the way that it's lilted to the right, given that Malcolm Turnbull's 2017 reset seems to be, come on, love me, backbench, please do. This is where we are now. The man who, you know, so many of us thought would rush to the centre and combine, where most Australians are, and I keep saying this, the economic rationalism combined with the fairly liberal social policy, this is just dead in the water, isn't it?
I'm not sure that it is.
Is there a plan?
We have... Look,
I
certainly
keep wanting there to be a plan. It's nearly a year and counting, but I'm still hoping. Come on, Malcolm. Bring the plan.
Whether or not this will actually come about is, I think, a really difficult question to answer. It's certainly chum in the water for exactly the kind of people that you would expect it to be.
Look, we're not expecting the plan to be likely to succeed. The odds are stacked against it. But any sort of a plan, any sort of brilliance that I haven't so far been able to figure out, Richie, please enlighten me.
Look, I'm not sure. I'm not a, you know, I'm not a soothsayer. I can't tell what's going on.
Why are you
going
wearing
on.
Those robes then?
But
I sacrificed my child to you. I have no children.
I'm not anymore.
So I think that part of the place that they're getting cover from to make this decision, and part of the way that Turnbull has been able to convince himself that it's a kind of pseudo centre-right decision, is from Japan and Germany, both of whom are building new coal-fired power plants. Japan quite a lot, because they have to replace...
Actually, that's a good point.
They made that decision to replace nuclear power.
Post-Fukushima.
Yeah.
Why so? I mean, everything seems to have worked out pretty well with nuclear power in Japan, right?
It's true. If you hit a coal-fired power station, look, I'll completely concede, if you hit it with a tsunami, much less bad than if you hit a nuclear power plant with a tsunami. In their case, it does make a degree of sense, except for the fact that Japan is already massively polluted. But still, I guess as a bridging technology, given the massive number of lights on their pachinko parlors, which have to be lit nightly, maybe coal is a stopgap for them.
At all times. And I think part of it is that they want diversified power as well. That's their rationale.
Well, this is the coalition's other argument. Yep. It's actually not such a bad argument. I don't understand South Australia, the post-mortem, well enough, except to say that the experts seem to think that it wasn't to do with renewable energy at all, so much as network design and a freakish event. But, yeah.
When bits fall off, generally things don't work as well, just as a rule. And with South Australia, quite a lot of bits fell off.
You didn't tell me you were an electrical engineer.
That's my background. My background's in electrical grid design and repair.
Very impressive. So talk me through Germany, because when you're in the air above Germany, which is I've been precisely one time, you see a lot of massive windmills in the countryside there.
Yeah, and Germany has, you know, famously decided that it's going to sort of run the space program style jump to renewable energy, which has been a mixed success. And it seems like part of their kind of dirty secret is that they like selling power to other countries. And the best way to do that for them is to fire up a whole lot of filthy lignite power stations and then let the Belgians pick up the tab.
Presumably they're all in the east and they're just used to the dour, grimy environment.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure how the pollution kind of side of things works. They probably have scrubbers galore, but they seem to be moving slightly, you know, they're certainly putting their toe in the water in that direction again. Partly because, you know, this is just so complicated.
So having read about this, it seems that, and I'm certainly no expert, but it seems as though even people who have lived their entire life in the coal industry, basically they are coal, their lungs are full of coal, they've got the black lung pop. They reckon that any new coal-fired power plants for Australia would be ludicrous, would be ridiculously expensive and would never happen. So
Malcolm Roberts does not say that. That's ridiculous.
In his case, the fumes went to his head. But is this what we're going to see? So we export it to people who are still using it, still prop up our plants for a bit, but essentially it's a slow downward spiral. Is that what's going to happen?
I think so. This is a pure guess. If it does get built, I think it will end up like a New South Wales salination plant style where it's just basically built as a kind of symbol of your political intentions and then mothballed at vast expense.
Well, the other thing that occurred to me about certainly why I think this is a debate as opposed to why I think this is necessarily a strategy is that it's almost, if I was Turnbull, this would be a very good way to try and goad Labor into doing something very, very lefty. To see them double down and go, no, we're going to go 100% renewable energy.
Actually,
target.
Perhaps this is what his plan is. I keep hoping it's there somewhere. Perhaps what he does is he gives, and you know, I just keep pointing to me. I keep wanting him to be better than he, on all evidence, is. Maybe what he does is he pushes through and fully embraces things that he knows are not going to get through the Senate. So he gives it his all, like the plebiscite. He backs it. And knowing that it's going to get shot down, and then he can start from scratch. I mean, I can't imagine Labor's going to switch.
Just like he has with marriage equality and the way that's now totally sorted.
Well, yes. Yeah. But you've got to start again, right? That's the thing. And so perhaps in a year's time, he'll be, look, I've tried all your stuff, guys. He's not going to be there anymore. What am I saying?
I don't want to shock you. I don't want to shock you, but Labor is wavering on the renewable energy target already.
It's 50% by...
It already looks like, even though, and this is, it's very difficult, it shows you how seriously they take this threat. The focus groups are very much in favour of the renewable energy target, and Labor are wavering on it. So wow. It must be a matter of great principle to them if they're willing
Labor.
To sell it out.
It is Labor. Hmm. I mean, they don't do principles. It's always an illusion when it looks like they will.
They're nothing if not expedient.
The Oz had a piece yesterday, Labor finally realises that its RET is an election-losing policy. So the Australians' position on it is very clear. So 2020, they're looking at. It is a very aggressive and bold move. So Australian politics being what it is, it definitely won't happen. We haven't done anything bold since Howard, have we? No, we haven't. Even then. Yeah, we don't do
I'm trying to think what it was. What, the GST?
GST was bold. Yeah, going to the election on GST. I mean, Keating and Hawke were proper bold.
Whitlam was get bold. Up, do something bold, then have breakfast.
He would. That didn't last for very long.
No.
So there you go. So none of this is going to happen. And do you think then, this being the case, that there'll be a compromise and things will kind of use a bit of coal and kind of use a bit of renewable and kind of muddle on, because that's just what Australian politics' default setting is?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that a version of that will happen all over the world. Like, let's take a similar catastrophic problem with not even remotely comparable complexity, which is, you know, antibiotic resistance. It should be really, really easy to solve antibiotic resistance.
Mm.
It's a terrible problem. It has the potential to kill millions of people.
It could kill us all. Yep.
All you have to do pretty much is stop giving antibiotics to pigs, and we can't do it. So something as complicated as climate change, you know, that's the umbrella issue here. I think the chances of it being solved in the time scale necessary almost zero.
Well, isn't the grand arch of human progress?
And, I've just had a child.
He might last for... Anyway, no, let's not curse him at this point. It is a special day.
Please, no more child sacrifices. I beg you. It's getting embarrassing.
I remember reading Andrew Charlton, the economist who was the centre of the Oscar business. He wrote a quarterly essay a few years ago, basically saying that the grand arch of human history is that our policymakers massively fuck up, completely fail to rise to challenges, essentially steal our fate, and then science saves us. It's happened time and time again with things like, you know, hunger and famine and the potato famine, all that kind of stuff. And we just end up making these quantum leaps forward scientifically. So what I'm basically saying is those scientists who haven't had their jobs cut by CSIRO slashing or the Trump or whatever, you got to step up. And essentially, probably what will happen is in the next 20 years, renewable energy will get so cheap and so easy that we'll be amazed we even had this debate.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that that's the case, but also the scientific wins of the past were sometimes a lot easier than they are now. Like, we don't
have... Well, there were investments in science back then, which...
Yeah, but even before that period, I mean, we don't have sort of maybe shitting in our water supply is a bad idea level low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I'm not convinced.
True, yeah. That's very true.
I'm not convinced. Remember Galileo and Copernicus?
Yeah. I can't wait for Malcolm Roberts to rail against this non-shitting in the water.
There's a hill to die on, Malcolm. If you wonder, what I suggest you do is get a water tank,
dysentery,
get a closed system and have a crack. Have a crack, just hook it up to the cistern and let's just see how much faith you have in science.
They said Galileo was wrong as well.
I said a lot of things.
And look at him now. Where is he? Dead.
Exactly.
He finally... all right. Well, I think that pretty much solves the energy debate.
Yeah,
that's it. What else is cooking in Australian politics, Andrew?
Well, we did have sort of a bit of a reprise of one of Joe Hockey's greatest hits. Of course, Diamond Joe Hockey, our former treasurer, who memorably insisted that the way to solve Australia's housing crisis was to get a good job with a good salary.
And didn't he just...
And
ambassador to Washington Hockey with a good, he got a free house. That's the ultimate solution to the problem.
He did exceptionally well out of this. I mean, you know, he's a man who walks it like he talks it.
Corrupt son of a real estate agent.
Well,
location, location, location. Washington DC, Embassy Row.
And then Michael, is it Suka? I don't know how to pronounce his surname.
I think Sucker is probably the way that most of us are feeling about him today.
That's what I thought it might be, but I thought maybe I'm just showing my own stripes.
If I was still at the ABC, I'd have a computer system that told me how to pronounce it, but I'm just going to go with my instinct, which is Suka. Mm. But yeah, we couldn't be lucky enough that it was Sucker. That's too easy.
That is too easy.
Easy a joke.
Let's say it's Suka. Anyway, he was on Sky on Monday night. where he more or less said the same thing. It was slightly more qualified than Hockey's comment, but it was essentially that the number one way to begin to address housing affordability was basically good jobs. And this is part of the larger idea of, you know, if we fix the economy, then everything else will fall into place, which is, you know, very much the standard liberal template sort of policy umbrella. If you can have a template policy umbrella, I'm mixing my metaphors here.
Yeah, let's give some people comfortable conditions, and the rest of you can go to hell. Isn't that the basic model there?
Well, I think the idea is that you get a good, solid economy, and then everybody will get good jobs, and we'll all be able to buy good houses because we'll all have such good jobs. Because apparently, money's not finite, and property just keeps springing up like mushrooms. I'm not sure how he thinks this works.
The bold thing he said to Sky News is we're also enabling young people to get highly paid jobs, which is the first step to buying a house. Mm. Is that as drug dealers? What are these jobs, Richie? What's going on? Is there something I'm missing? Are kids going and buying? I remember there was that lovely young lady who ran the ice distribution network a short while ago. But other than her, what are these mysterious jobs that are getting the kids into houses?
Look, I'm not an economist, so... Before I'm
not a soothsayer, not an economist. What is it that you do?
It's clearly been a mistake inviting me on this show. But I checked this with an economist because I just wanted to be sure before I said this.
If only he had.
But my understanding is that increased demand increases cost as well, right? So when he says that people's wages are going to increase and they're going to be able to afford houses because of that, the increased wages will increase the cost of the houses.
Yeah.
And the cost of the houses relative, if the housing supply is the same or relatively the same, it's going to be the same.
That does make more sense. If everyone's got more money, they can afford to pay more for the thing. Look at the Premier League football. It makes plenty of sense.
It's very similar. So
whereas if you...
I want to see how hard you can torture that analogy.
It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm just very depressed about my team at the moment. Anyway... No, clearly supply, increasing supply is the way to get prices down, is it not? Or a way. Or negative gearing is... I'm not an economist either, obviously, but the things that seem to be touted in terms of pushing prices down... And this is the thing, this is the big problem with the coalition on this issue, is they refuse to countenance the idea of anyone's house being worthless.
Yeah.
And you can't. You can't have your cake and eat it on this.
Well, given either prices, their idea is that we're going to make housing more affordable and also the same price. I mean, that seems to be...
If everyone magically has more money with which to buy houses, then yeah, and the house prices magically didn't go up as a result, then that would happen.
Mm.
Unfortunately, they're not that good at the wizardry thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're not soothsayers either. And it would probably be a better investment long term to buy a house than a minor league kind of level Premier League footballer.
They do get injured a lot.
Yeah. But they're probably comparable, you know, comparable levels. Like in Sydney, you could probably like get an apartment.
1.6 million? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. What, like maybe like Fulham striker or something.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. The not so dirty secret is that they don't want to decrease house prices because they can't, because turning around and saying to their base that their number one asset should be worthless is political suicide.
Oh, 100%. Yep. And the people who are, you know, I mean, again, not to get too class war about this, but the people who aren't buying houses are not the people who typically are voting Liberal. So in terms of the costs to their vote in maintaining a situation where the wealthy get wealthier isn't going to do them any damage electorally.
Well, rewind back to the Howard era, late 90s, early 2000s, and you had a whole bunch of people mortgaged the Hilt in Western Sydney and other kind of, I suppose, edge of city areas. And those people now have made it. The prices have generally gone up quite, particularly in Western Sydney. So they've all made an absolute monster out of this whole situation. And so, yeah, there's nothing's going to change on housing affordability. If Michael Sucker, who's been asked to, or Sucker, however you want to say it, he's the guy, he's specifically the MP who's supposed to come up with the government's policy on this. If all he can come up with is get a good job, where seriously we're doing it, forget it. We're never going to live in houses. Unless Labor has the guts, and frankly they probably don't, to come in and end negative gearing and actually let prices drop, what's going to give?
There have been some people, you know, Andrew Hastie is an example of this, who have criticized negative gearing, but it's not going to happen. It's very hard to see how it can happen. So your only hope, as always, especially in New South Wales politics, is to hope that the corrupt side of things is more powerful. So we have to hope that,
come,
you know,
back, Eddie, you beat, always, yeah, forgiven.
That crooked property developers are our only hope. We need like tons of shoddy apartment buildings.
What is happening? Yeah, just build them over all the train lines everywhere, and maybe some more floating in the middle of the harbour. Get Blizz Point Tower to replicate all over the shoreline, and we'll be sweet.
Mm. Yep.
Just, to be fair, that does seem to be happening. I mean, they're made of biscuit, as far as I can work out. They certainly don't look like they could sort of support the weight of a human adult.
Sea biscuit.
Well, it's unusually flammable for biscuit as well.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. They're toasty biscuits. That's a. But I mean, the other thing is, and again, I think we've mentioned this on this podcast before.
What are the odds?
But the fact that negative gearing, which is something which the federal government can do about housing prices, changing negative gearing, changing capital gains tax, is another thing that which they can do. Those two things are ruled out. And the thing that keeps coming up is, oh, we increase supply, which is something which the federal government can't do. The federal government does not have control over this is a state and local government issue.
Unless
so this is
to
a chance
fang
for them to
back into the public housing business a la Whitlam, yeah.
Well, precisely. And this is, so it's a very good way to make a lot of noise whilst shifting the blame to everybody else. So again, you know, for a government which, to, as we have said, is in something of a state of inertia, it does give the impression of movement without actually committing them to do anything. And you know, words, as well we know, as published writers, are cheap.
Huh. Certainly, yes. Certainly these days. Well, the other thing is, when you're talking about negative gearing, the thing you've got to remember when we're talking about housing affordability is that this is, it only applies for your second home. So all the people who are worried about their particular castle getting undermined, it's about people who are rich enough to buy the houses that other people should be buying and living in, really. That's what's so incredibly annoying about it.
You say that, Dom, but you know, if you have to start giving up your fourth and fifth investment property, then you know the whole house of cards is going to fall down. The dominoes are going to be checkmated. That's what's going to happen.
You know what it is? Socialism.
Socialism. Creeping socialism.
Creeping socialism. Finally, let's have a quick look at the WA election and One Nation. The fun continues. Malcolm Turnbull's come out today and said, just because we're preferencing One Nation doesn't mean we like them. Quite the contrary, doesn't mean that we think you should vote for them. There you go. So it's not an endorsement. It's like a retweet. It's not an endorsement. It's just simply a deal, Richie. Do you buy that?
I think you have to give it partial credit because people hate each other in politics so much. You know, they certainly don't like people that they're preferencing in their own parties a lot of the time. So yes, it's a
roiling snake bit.
Yeah, it's not a love letter when you preference someone, but exactly what has made One Nation supposedly more sophisticated since it was put last in its preferences and how it is now? You know, part of the mythology of the kind of Liberal Party is that they took this stand on the basis of decency, and exactly why they've retracted that stand, and even Howard himself has retracted that stand. They can't identify this element which has changed.
Oh, they can. Oh, you absolutely can. It's a shift from racism against Asians to bigotry against a religion. That's a very
much
different.
More sophisticated.
Chris Kenny's written extensively about this. The Muslim ban. Firstly, it's not a Muslim ban, but you know, that's not racist. Just because the vast majority of Muslims happen to be non-white, there are at least a handful of white Muslims out there. QED, not racist. That's sophisticated, Richie. If that isn't classy and very much 2017, I don't know what is.
It's also interesting to see how people have made that argument when previously some of the same people were arguing that there should be racial profiling of Muslims on the basis of their likelihood to commit terrorist attacks in airports and such.
We're just in a very good place, aren't we?
Sophisticated.
And plus, they've got Malcolm Roberts. And look, they didn't previously have people who could explain things. I mean, Pauline Hanson had no idea about anything. Malcolm Roberts has very sophisticated, insane ideas about any number of topics. I mean, he can flummox climate scientists.
I'm not sure that it's flummox so much as frustrate.
Well, this is the thing. Ties up in knots with... It's like... He's the Australian Lord Monckton. He's capable of creating... a towering edifice of pure bullshit to the extent that Pauline Hanson certainly can't do. Yeah. Sophisticated.
Pauline Hanson can't string that many sentences together in one go. So to do the, what's it called? The something gush? The gish gush? There's a term for this which comes from skepticism. There's a creationist who would just plough out these, you know, make so many claims in such a short space of time that rebutting them is nearly impossible.
Mm. You tower up your assumptions. You've got about 20 or 30 each step in the chain is problematic, but they come so quickly that you can't even deal with them.
Yeah, and look, it wasn't very long ago that even Andrew Bolt was turning around and saying, look, Malcolm Roberts has made these comments about international banking families. They're clearly anti-Semitic. I don't want anything to do with him. And now you can read editorials in The Australian saying he's got sensible ideas about tax reform. You know, it's the tent seems to be getting a lot wider these days and a lot narrower in some other parts.
He's burrowed his way into the colon of so many on the right.
But it's such a weird thing. I mean, one of the things which I was reading one of Anthony Green's blogs that I... To be fair, I will say that this was kind of my sort of prejudicial assumption, and then I sort of started doing research to see if I was completely wrong, and I was very, very gratified to see that I was broadly, well, in the Anthony Green thinks similarly, and if Anthony Green thinks it, then it's obviously right, because that man, as we have discussed earlier, he comes from a different and better planet where numbers are pets, and... The thing about what happened last time around when One Nation sort of appeared to split the vote is it took a little bit of a vote from Labour, but it took a chunk of vote from the Coalition. And the amount of vote that it took from Labour was offset by the amount of Coalition voters who moved, sort of centrist Coalition voters who moved to Labour. So this deal seems to have... like rather than kind of saving the Barnett government, seems to risk really just handing Labour a walk-in. And I realise that that's not what the polling is saying. Well, the polling is saying it's about 50-50.
That's what preference whisperer Glenn Drury said would happen. But it also seems certain to give, or very likely to give, One Nation the balance of power in the upper house. So
absolutely, it does.
What a deal they're doing. But what it seems to actually be about as much as anything else, and this is something that hasn't been mentioned in many of the articles, but I kind of hinted at last week, I couldn't remember the guy's name. Tony Crook was the guy who was the lower house MP who, despite being from the WA Nationals, wasn't sure whether to vote for Julia Gillard or Tony Abbott. And the point is, WA Nationals refused to be part of the Coalition. And I'm sorry, if you're not going to sign up to it, you're going to get One Nation gazumped like this. So what it seems to be, as much as anything else, is a salvo against WA Nationals saying, get inside the tent, you idiots, to which WA Nationals seem to be going, no, we like it over here, do whatever. And so, look, WA is different. Frankly, they wanted to be a different country. Perhaps they should be.
I've long been of the opinion that WA should be allowed to secede and then reinvaded and turn into a vassal state of the rest of Australia.
That's a very good model. Yeah, why not?
Maybe we can just stick all of our coal power plants there and then sell the energy off to Belgium.
Top idea.
Yeah. Look, we could get this budget repaired. All we've got to do is invade WA.
Yeah, look, if they were a client, they wouldn't hear any more whinging about GST revenues, but what would be very good.
We could get onshore detention. We just move everybody there.
The world's largest prison.
This is nothing but good ideas.
Dare to dream. Look, I think... this is probably the most economically focused installment we've had of the podcast so far. It's been interesting. It's been different. Richard, I'm very grateful for your relative knowledge and insight into these matters. No offence.
Oh, you're Andrew making Peace me blush. Street.
Thanks a bunch.
But that was very interesting. You can read Richie's amazing piece on James Packer and his casino empire in the monthly. He contributes to there regularly. He's also working on The Checkout, coming soon to ABC TV. Travels the world, does exciting stuff, and occasionally drops in to talk to us.
Always a pleasure.
Andrew, we can read you more than daily in Fairfax and elsewhere, it seems.
This is true.
And see you on stage March the 7th and April the 4th so far. And look, possibly even more economic policy on the stage that night.
Hot financial action.
It's going to be amazing. You book now, giantdwarf.com.au. Catch you next week. Unless we all chuck on coffee in the meantime.
Farewell.